Corpse Taker had taken the lectors out of the picture, and without the mad spirit's ability to manifest in the physical world, my thoughts sped to quicksilver flickering. Frantic memory hit me like a hammer. Hell's bells. Every time I've run into a ghost, it's tried to rip my lungs out. You're telling me none of your spooks can do something? They're sane, Mort shouted back. It's crazy for a ghost to interact with a physical world. Sane ghosts don't go around acting crazy. For a ghost, manifesting in the material world was an act of madness. A memory trying to enforce its will on the living, the past struggling to steer the course of the present. It was, according to everything I had learned about magic and life, an inversion of the laws of nature, a defiance of the natural order. Ghosts who weren't super mighty manifested all the time. It wasn't a question of raw power, and it never had been. It was a matter of desire. You just had to be crazy enough to make it happen. That was what the Corpse Taker had gotten from devouring the lectors. Not sufficient power, but sufficient insanity. She just had to be crazy enough to make it happen. For a wizard running around as a lost soul, expending his very essence in an attempt to rescue a guy who hadn't even really been his friend, was definitely of questionable rationality. Grabbing the leashes of several dozen maniac ghosts and leading them on a bonsai charge against a far stronger foe was probably less than stable, too. Hell, even the last few major choices of my life. Murdering Susan in order to save our child, giving myself to Mab so that I could save little Maggie, were not the acts of a stable, sane man. Neither had been my entire career, really, given the options that had been available to me. I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I could have used my abilities to make money if I'd wanted to. A lot of money. Instead, a little basement apartment. A job catering to clientele who hadn't merely needed help, they'd needed a miracle. Money? Not much. The occasional good deed, sure, but you can't eat sincere thanks. Girls don't flock to the guy who drives the old car, reads a lot of books, and kicks down the doors of living nightmares. My own people in the White Council had persecuted me my whole life, mostly for trying to do the right thing, and I'd kept on doing it anyway. Hell, I was pretty much crazy already. That being the case, how hard could it be? It would take a certain amount of energy, I was sure. Maybe everything I had left. It wouldn't get me any closer to the answers I wanted. It wouldn't let me find out who had murdered me. It might destroy me altogether. Heck, for that matter, if it took too much power to pull off, it could snuff me here and now. But the alternative? Watching Morty die? Not going to happen. I'd face oblivion first. I gripped the wooden grain of my staff, recalling the feelings that had surged through me when I had summoned and bound the lectors. I called on my memories, one more time. I called up the ache of sore muscles after a hard workout, and the sheer physical joy of my body in motion during a run, walking down the street, sinking into a hot bath, swimming through cool water, stroking over the softness of another body beside mine. I thought of my favorite old T-shirt, a plain black cotton one with 98% chimpanzee written on the chest in white typeset letters. I thought of the creak of my old leather cowboy boots, the comfort of a good pair of jeans, the scent of a wood-smoked grill drifting into my nose when I was hungry, the way my mouth would water and my stomach would growl. I thought of my old Mickey Mouse alarm clock going off too early in the morning and groaning out of bed to go to work. I remembered the smell of a favorite old book's pages when I opened them again, and the smell of smoldering motor oil, a staple feature of my old Blue Beetle. I remembered the softness of Susan's lips against mine. I remembered my daughter's slight, warm weight in my arms, her exhausted body as limp as a rag doll's. I remembered the way tears felt, sliding free of my eyes, the annoying blockage of congestion when I had a cold, and a thousand other things, little things, minor things, desperately important things. You know, life. Then I did something fairly nutty as I gathered the memory for what I was to attempt. I just uttered the spell in plain old English. The energy seared through my thoughts in a way that would have been damaging to a living wizard, maybe fatal. It seemed appropriate to use it here, and I released whatever power I had left, clothing it in garments of memory as I murmured the most basic of ideas, the foundation of words and of reality. Be. My universe shook. There was a vast rushing sound, rising to a crescendo that would have made a sane person flinch and crouch down to find shelter. And in a sudden burst of silence, I stood firmly in cold, dank dimness. The cold raised goose flesh on my skin. Shadows had swollen to cover almost all the details around me, and no wonder they had. All the candles and lamps that lit the chamber had burned down to little pinpoints. I tapped Boz on the shoulder and said, "Hey, gorgeous." His face twisted in complete surprise, turning to stare in blank incomprehension at mine. I winked at him and whispered, "Boo." And then I slugged him with my quarterstaff. It hurt. I mean, more than the shock of impact that lanced up through my wrists. I was solid again, at least for a moment. I was myself again, and with my remembered body came a fountain of remembered pain. My legs and knees creaked and ached, something that was a natural progression for a big guy, a kind of background pain that I never noticed until it was gone, and then back again. I hadn't exactly stretched out, and I'd socked Boz with everything I had. I'd torn a muscle in my back doing it. My head wasn't clear, suddenly riddled with a catalog of muscle twitches, physically painful hunger, and old injuries I'd just learned to ignore, now suddenly screaming in fresh agony. I've said before that only the dead feel no pain, but I'd never spoken from experience before. Pain, used as a weapon, is one thing. Personal pain, the kind that comes from just living our lives, is something else. Pain isn't a lot of fun, at least not for most folks, but it is utterly unique to life. Pain, physical, emotional, and otherwise, is the shadow cast by everything you want out of life, the alternative to the result you were hoping for, and the inevitable creator of strength. From the pain of our failures, we learn to be better, stronger, greater than what we were before. Pain is there to tell us when we've done something badly. It's a teacher, a guide, one that is always there to both warn us of our limitations and challenge us to overcome them. For something no one likes, pain does a whole hell of a lot of good. Stepping back into my old self and moving instantly into violent motion hurt like hell. It was amazing. I let out a whoop of sheer adrenaline and mad joy as Boz tumbled back over Mort's recumbent form. "Oof!" Mort shouted. "Dresden!" A howl of excitement came rolling out of Sir Stuart's throat, and he clenched his fist in vicious satisfaction, flashing briefly into full color. "Aye! Set boot to arse, boy!" Boz came up into a crouch pretty smoothly for someone of his bulk and stayed there, low on all fours, an animal that saw no advantage in learning to stand erect. Absolutely no sign of discomfort showed on his face, even though I'd split open his cheek with a blow from my staff, and blood joined the other substances encrusting his face. Hell's bells. My staff wasn't exactly a toothpick. It was as heavy as 3 baseball bats. I wasn't a toothpick either. I wasn't sure of my weight in baseball bats, but I could look down at a lot of guys in the NBA, and I wasn't a scrawny kid anymore. The point being that the blow, delivered with all the power of my shoulders, hips, and legs, as well as my arms, should have knocked Boz out, or killed him outright. I'd been aiming for his temple. He'd jerked his head back so that the end of my staff hit his left cheekbone instead. Hell, I might have broken it. But instead of collapsing in pain, he just crouched there, silent, stony eyes looking right through me as he faced me without flinching. I began to gather my will and staggered, nearly falling on my face. I had nothing left. It was only that burning flash of irrational certainty that had driven me to attempt to manifest that was keeping me on my feet at all, and I realized with a cold little chill that I might not be able to stop Boz from killing Morty. "Good Lord, I'm regretting this now," I muttered. "I have never, ever smelled B.O. this bad in my life. And I once had s'mores with a Sasquatch."
"Hang out with him for a while," Mort gasped. "Eventually it's not so bad."
"Wow, really?"
"No, not really."
I kept my eyes on Boz, but did my best to grin at Mort. He'd been strung up and tortured by lunatics for almost 24 hours, and his executioner was still trying to finish the job. But he still had the guts to engage in badinage. Anyone with that kind of spirit in the face of horror is okay in my book. Boz came at me like a predator, a smooth, swift motion that moved his whole body at once, unfettered by any kind of reluctance or hesitation. He never rose to do it, either. He flung himself forward as much with his arms as his legs, and his body's center of mass never came much higher than my knees. I gave him a boot to the head. I literally kicked him in the head with my hiking boot, and it was like stubbing my toe on a large rock. He just plowed on through the kick and hit me at the knees. Boz had a lot of mass. We went down, me on my ass, him lying on my lower legs. He started trying to claw his way up my body to my throat. I declined to allow him such liberties, and communicated that desire to him by thrusting the end of my staff at his neck. He slapped at the staff with one paw and caught it in an iron grip. I tried to roll away. He got his other hand on the weapon. We wrenched and wrestled for control of it. He was stronger than me. He was heavier than me. I had slightly more leverage, but not enough to make the difference. Then Boz surged forward, driving with tree-trunk legs, and I went down on my back. All his weight came down on the staff, and he drove it toward my throat. Temporary body or not, it still worked the same way as the one I was used to. If Boz crushed my windpipe, the body would die. If that happened, I assumed I would be left behind, immaterial again, while the false flesh collapsed into ectoplasm, the way ghosts and demons were driven back to their spirit forms when their temporary bodies were destroyed. But we were getting pretty far out of my comfort zone when it came to ghostly lore. Boz bore down, and it was all I could do to keep him from choking me with my own staff. I couldn't even dream of moving him. He had 75 or 80 pounds on me, all of them solid, stinking mass, and he was coming at me with a silently psychotic determination. But he hadn't realized where we had fallen. I released the staff with my right hand, and his shoulders bunched, his back rounding out in a massive hump of trapezius muscles. My one hand wasn't able to do much to hold him back, and I felt the harsh pain of blood trying to hammer through the arteries Boz was compressing. With my right hand, I seized the ends of the jumper cables still attached to the heavy-duty automobile battery, the one Morty had been tortured with, and jammed the metal ends of them both against the freshly blood-soaked side of Boz's face. It wasn't exactly a surgical strike. I was holding both clamps in the same hand, and only a couple of seconds from being choked unconscious, after all, but it worked. The clamps touched each other, and wet skin and sparks flew. Boz convulsed and jerked away from the sudden source of agony, a reflex action as immutable as pulling your arm away from a searing hot panhandle. He shifted his weight, and I pushed up, adding every ounce of muscle I had to aid the movement. He pitched off me, rolling, and I followed him, letting go of the staff and looping the main body of the jumper cable around his neck. He thrashed and tried to get away, but I had gotten onto his back and locked my legs around his hips. I grabbed the cable in both hands and hauled back on it with everything I had. It was over pretty quick, though it didn't feel like it at the time. Boz thrashed and struggled. But as heavily muscled as he wasn't flexible enough to get his arms back and up to reach where I was on his back. so he couldn't pull me off. He tried to break away, but between the cable and the grip of my legs, he wasn't able to shake me off. He tried to get his fingers in beneath the jumper cable, but though he managed to get in a couple of digits, I was pulling too hard and was more than strong enough to outmuscle one of his fingers. I don't care how crazy you are. When your brain doesn't get oxygen, you go down. Boz did, too. I held a choke for another 10 seconds to make sure he wasn't playing possum on me, and then for 15, then 20. Someone was snarling a string of curses, and I hadn't realized it was me. The simple sensation of straining power, of primal victory, surged through me like a drug, and only the coup de grace remained. I ground my teeth. I'd killed men and women before, but never when I'd had an alternative. I might be a fighter, but I wasn't a killer. Not when there was a choice. I forced myself to let go of the cables, and Boz flopped to the ground, entirely limp but alive. I had to roll him off one of my legs, pushing with my other heel, but he finally went, and I shambled upright, breathing hard. Then I turned to Mort and started untying knots. He watched me with wary eyes.
Dresden, what you're doing, being in the flesh like that, it isn't right.
I know, I said, but no one else was going to do it. He shook his head.
I'm just saying, it isn't good for you. Those spirits, the ones I'd been sheltering, they weren't any different from any other ghost when they got started doing this. It does things to you long term. You'll change.
He leaned a little toward me.
Right now, you're still you. But what you felt there at the end, it grows. Keep doing this, and you won't be you anymore.
I'm almost done, I told him, jerking the ropes clear as fast as I could. It took a bit. They'd strung him up pretty carefully, distributing his weight across a lot of rope. I guess Corpse Taker hadn't wanted to spend several hours getting her limbs back under control once Mort cracked. He groaned and tried to sit up. It took him a couple of attempts, but when I tried to help him, he waved my offer away. Can you walk? I asked him. He shuddered.
I can damn well walk out of here. Just give me a minute.
I don't have it, I said. I've got to move.
Why?
Because my friends are up there somewhere. He sucked in a breath. I know, I said with a grimace. Then I rose, grabbed my staff, and started walking toward the stairs.
Stu, I heard Morty say, you know Knots, right?
I glanced back and saw Sir Stuart nod. Mort nodded back and started gathering up the coils of rope I'd pulled off him. He beckoned to Sir Stuart.
Come in. I don't want the Man Mountain there getting up and finishing what he started.
I almost hesitated to make sure Mort was all right, but I'd spent too much time down here already, and I could feel the hectic buzz of my fatigue growing by the moment. I had to get upstairs. There was only one reason Corpse Taker would have taken down her own wards as she had. She wasn't limited to such a small sampling of humanity now when it came to seizing a new body. She'd wanted people to come inside her lair. It would give her more variety to choose from. I rushed up the stairs, praying that I would be in time to stop Kemmler's protege from taking one of my friends for keeps. Chapter 48. I pounded up the stairs and found that it was getting dark. Damn it. I'd gotten way too used to the upside of ghostliness. I reached up to my neck to find my mother's pentacle amulet and it wasn't there, which it should have been. I mean, my actual duster had been destroyed, but the one I was wearing was an exact duplicate. There was no reason my mother's amulet shouldn't have been there, but it wasn't. That was possibly something significant. But I didn't have time to worry about it at the moment. Instead, I sent a whisper of will into my staff, and the runes carved in it began to glow with blue-white wizard light, casting their shapes in pure light on the moldy stone walls and floor of the hallway, showing me the way. I didn't have much magic left in me, But a simple light spell was much, much easier than any kind of violent spell, requiring far less energy. I ran down the hall, past the filthy sleeping rooms with curtains for doors, and through the break in the wall, to the old electrical junction room. A flashlight lay on the floor, spilling light onto a patch of wolf fur from a couple of inches away and otherwise doing nothing to illuminate the scene. I had to brighten the light for my staff to see that Murphy and the wolves were lying in a heap on the floor next to the unconscious Big Hoods. The corpse taker was nowhere to be seen. Neither was Molly. I turned in a slow circle, looking for any sign of what had happened, and found nothing. Feet scraped on rock, and I turned swiftly, bringing up my staff, ready to unleash whatever power I had left in me, and found Butters standing halfway down the stairs, looking like a rabbit about to bolt. His face was pale as a sheet behind his glasses, and his dark hair was a wild mess.
"My God," he breathed. "Dresden?"
"Back for a limited engagement," I breathed, lowering my staff. "Butters, what happened?"
I don't know. They started shouting something, and then they just collapsed.
"And you didn't?" I asked.
"I was out there," he said, pointing behind him. "You know, looking out for the police or whatever."
"Being eyes, huh?" I said. I turned back to Murphy and the wolves.
"Yeah, pretty much," he said.
He moved quietly down the stairs.
"Are they all right?"
I crouched down over Murphy and felt her neck. Her pulse was strong and steady. Ditto for the nearest of the wolves. "Yeah," I said, my heart slowing down a little. "I think she..." Something cold and hard pressed against the back of my head. I looked down. Murphy's SIG was missing from its holster.
"Everyone trusts a doctor," purred Butters, in a tone of voice that Butters would never have used. "Even wizards, Dresden."
I felt myself tensing.
Corpse taker. "You were able to manifest after all. Intriguing. You've a natural gift for darker magic, I think. My master would have snapped you up in an instant."
I'd spent an afternoon working with Murphy on gun disarms at Dojo's Hurricane Gym. I tried to remember which way I had to spin to attempt to take the gun away. It depended on how it was being held, and I had no idea how Corpse Taker was holding the weapon on me. I was pretty sure Butters was a lefty, but I didn't think that would matter to the corpse taker once she set up shop. "Oh, boy, I could have hung out with people like you. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have worked out."
"Possibly not," corpse taker said. "I accorded you far more respect than you merited as an opponent. How much of you is left behind that body you've cobbled together? Scarcely more than one of those pathetic wraiths, I think. You could have made a viable move in time, but clearly you've no patience, no head for strategy."
"Yeah, I guess I still got a soul and a conscience where you installed that stuff."
"Soul? Conscience?"
Corpse Taker said, almost laughing.
"Those are nothing but words. They aren't even true limits, just the figments of them, useless."
"Just because something isn't solid doesn't mean it isn't real," I said. "If you had a brain in your head, you'd know that."
"You're obsessed with the fantasies of the young," she replied with my friend's breath. "Though I must admit that the ironic reversal of our current state is simply delicious."
And without hesitation or any change in the tone of her voice, she put a bullet into the back of my head. The pain was infinitely brief and indescribable, a massive spike of agony. It felt as if it should have sent me flying. I saw a cloud of something fly forward and then splatter all over one of the wolves in the nearest Big Hood. Ectoplasm, I realized dully. My physical body had been destroyed. It had fallen back into the spirit matter from which I'd formed it. The pain faded, and then I was back in the still, neutral absence of sensation of the ghost state. I reached for the splattered matter with an instinctive, unspoken yearning to return to it. I could barely see my hand. I tried to turn around, but it felt like I was submerged in something thicker and more viscous than water, and it took forever. I stared into the corpse taker's eyes within Butters's face and watched the body-jumping lunatic smirk at me.
"Not much of you now, is there?" she murmured. "You'll be a wraith within days. I think that balances our account. Enjoy eternity, Dresden."
I tried to snarl a curse, but I was just so tired. I couldn't get the sound to come out of me. And by the time I had tried, Corpse Taker had taken Butters's body back to the bottom of the stairs. She was moving so fast. Or maybe I was just that slow. I tried to follow, and all I could manage was to drift in the Corpse Taker's wake, moving with grace, but slowly, so slowly. Corpse Taker made a gesture, and a veil fell away from another shade at the top of the stairs. It was Butters. He stood there, dressed not in his winter gear, but in the scrubs I was far more used to seeing him wear. He was completely motionless, except for his eyes, which rolled around frantically. A rapidly evaporating puddle of ectoplasm spread at his feet. An expression of pure confusion was locked onto his face. Corpse Taker had been a big fan of body switching. When she left me and Morty in the basement, she must have come directly up here to grab a new body. She probably dropped some variant of a sleeping spell on Murphy and the wolves, and then Butters must have shown up. Corpse Taker had gone with her usual trick, forcibly trading bodies with a victim, and the manifested ghost body she'd been in had fallen back into ectoplasm the moment she wasn't there to give it energy and form. Butters's essence, his soul, had just been booted out of his body, and now it stood there, vulnerable and unmoving, brightly colored but fading away even as I watched. She tossed a quick veil over Butters's shade, so that no one who might come upon her would see him standing there, forlorn and confused, while she drove around in his hijacked body. The thing that really got to me? Corpse Taker threw a little smirk back at me as she got to Butters's shade. There wasn't anything I could do to stop her, but she wanted me to see how thoroughly she'd outthought and outmaneuvered me. But the universe has a funny sense of humor, and apparently it's not always aimed at me. While Corpse Taker looked back at me to smirk, Molly rippled forth from under a veil of her own on the last step between Butters's stolen body and the explosion-chewed door. She grabbed the Corpse Taker by the front of Butters's coat. Butters wasn't exactly heroic in build. Molly, on the other hand, was several inches taller than he, and had her mother's genes, everything I'd been able to teach her about mixing it up, and 6 months of hard time under the tender guiding hand of the Linanshi. Molly slammed the Corpse Taker against the wall so hard that stolen teeth slammed together. Then she seized Butters's freaking face in a claw-like hand and thrust her head close, locking eyes with the Corpse Taker. I wanted to scream a negation, but nothing came out. I frantically tried to move faster. If I succeeded, it didn't show.
"You want to play head games?"
Molly snarled, her blue eyes blazing.
"Let's go."
The Corpse Taker's face contorted into an expression somewhere between murderous rage and that of an orgasm, and she opened her stolen eyes wide. Molly and the Dark Wizard went into a soul gaze, and there wasn't a thing I could do about it, except keep trying to get closer. I could feel power flickering between them, though, like bursts of heat coming out of a furnace, as I got glacially nearer. It was an entirely invisible struggle, a simultaneous and mutual siege of the personality. Mind magic is dangerous, slippery stuff, and doing combat with another mind is all about imagination, focus, and sheer willpower. Right now, Molly was thrusting an array of images and ideas at the Corpse Taker, trying to force the other to pay attention to them. Some of the thoughts would be there to undermine defenses, others to assault them, and still others trying to slip past unnoticed to wreak havoc from within. Some of the thoughts would be simple things, whispered doubts meant to shake the other's confidence, for example. Others would be far more complex constructions, idea demons imagined ahead of time, prepared for such an occasion, and unleashed upon the thoughts and memories of the foe. The White Council hated mind magic, generally speaking. If you beat someone's defenses, you could do a lot of things to them, and precious few of them were good. Events, however, had forced them to acknowledge the necessity of giving all of its members lessons in psychic self-defense that were more comprehensive than the simple wall technique that I'd been briefly introduced to. A couple of old-timers who knew how to play the game had begun dispensing the basics to everyone interested in learning. As it turned out, I had a natural fortress of a personality, which explained a lot, like how hard it had always been for a fairy glamour to trick me for long, and why I'd been able to grind through several forms of mental assault over the years. If someone came in after me, they had a big badass castle to contend with. They could pound on it all day, as such things were measured, without breaking the defenses, and I'd been told that it would take an extended campaign to conquer my head entirely. Like any decent castle, there were multiple lines and structures where new defenses could take hold. But I didn't have much of a forward game. For me, the best offense had to be an obstinate defense. Molly, on the other hand, well, Molly was sort of scary. Her castle wasn't huge and imposing. The damn thing was invisible, made of mirrors, covered in fog, wrapped in darkness, and generally hard even to pin down, much less besiege. Anyone who went into her head had better bring a GPS, a seeing eye dog, and a backup set of eyeballs. Worse, her offense was like dealing with a Mongolian horde. She'd send in waves and waves of every kind of mental construction imaginable, and while you were busy looking at those, ninja thoughts would be sneaking through your subconscious, planting the psychological equivalent of explosives. We'd practiced against each other a lot, immovable object versus irresistible force. It generally ended in a draw when Molly had to quit and nurse a headache, at which point I would join her in scarfing down aspirin. A couple of times my thuggish constructions had stumbled over her defenses and started breaking mirrors. A couple of times her horde had gotten lucky or particularly sneaky. We'd had the same thought image set up to signal victory. Vader swooping down in his TIE fighter, smugly stating, "I have you now." Once that got through, the game was over. But outside of practice, that thought could just as easily be something more like, "Put your gun into your mouth and pull the trigger." We both knew that. We both worked hard to improve as a result. It was part of the training I'd taken every bit as seriously as teaching her theory or enchantments or exorcism or any of 100 other areas we covered over the past few years. But we'd never done it for blood. The corpse taker moved Butters' hand up to gently frame Molly's cheeks and said,
"My, my, my. Training standards have improved."
Molly slammed Corpse Taker's head back against the wall with a short, harsh motion and said,
"Stop squirming and fight."
Corpse Taker bared Butters' teeth in a slow grin and suddenly surged forward, slamming Molly's back against the opposite wall while simultaneously moving up a stair so that their eyes were on the same level.
"Slippery little girl. But I was crushing minds like yours centuries before your great-grandfather's grandfather left the old country."
Molly suddenly let out a gasp, and her face twisted in pain.
"They never have the stomach to hurt their darling little apprentices," Corpse Taker crooned. "That's called pain. Let me give you a lesson."
"Lady," Molly panted, "did you pick the wrong part of my life in which to mess with me?" She took a deep breath and spoke in a ringing, furious voice.
"Now get the fuck out of my friend, Idiru!"
I felt the surge of her will as she spoke the word, and suddenly reality seemed to condense around my apprentice. There was a terrible, terrible force that ripped forth from her, pulling hungrily at everything around it. I'd felt something similar once, when a nascent White Court vampire had unintentionally begun to feed on me, an energy that spiraled and swirled and pulled at the roots of my senses. But that was only one facet of the gravity that Molly exuded with the spell. Corpse Taker's eyes widened in surprise and sudden strain. Then she snarled,
"Have it your way. The little doctor was my second choice in any case."
And then I saw Corpse Taker's dark, mad soul flow into my apprentice, on the tidal pull of the beckoning she'd performed. The expression of Butters' face went empty, and he collapsed, utterly without movement of any kind. 3 feet away, his shade's helpless, confused gaze locked onto his fallen physical form, and his eyes went wide with terror. Molly screamed in sudden shock and fear. In that instant, I saw in her eyes the reflection of her terror, the panic of someone who has come loaded for bear and found herself face to face with a freaking dinosaur instead. My drifting, dream-slow advance had finally gotten me close enough. With sluggish and agonizing grace, I stretched out one hand and caught the corpse-taker's ankle as she slithered into my apprentice. I settled my grip grimly and felt myself pulled forward into the havoc of the war for Molly's body, mind, and soul. Chapter 49. I landed in the middle of a war. There was a ruined city all around me. The sky above boiled with storm clouds, moving and roiling too quickly to be real, filled with contrasting colors of lightning. Rain hammered down. I heard screams and shouted imprecations all around me, overlapping one another, coming from thousands of sources, blending into a riotous roar, and every single voice was either Molly's or the corpse-taker's. As I watched, some great beast, somewhere between a serpent and a whale, smashed its way through a brick building, a fortress, I realized, maybe 50 yards away, thrashing about as it fell and grinding it to powder. A small trio of dots of bright red light appeared on the vast thing's rubble-dusted flanks, just like the targeting of a predator's shoulder cannon in the movies of the same name. And then multiple streaks of blue-white light flashed in from somewhere and blew a series of holes the size of train tunnels right through the creature. Around me, I saw groups of soldiers, many of them in sinister black uniforms, others looking like idealized versions of United States infantry laying into one another with weapons of every sort imaginable, from swords to rocket launchers. A line of tracer fire went streaking right through me, having no more effect than a stiff breeze. I breathed a faint sigh of relief. I was inside Molly's mindscape, but her conflict was not with me, and neither was the corpse-taker's. I was just as much a ghost here at the moment as I had been back in the real world. The city around me, I saw, was a vast grid of fortified buildings, and I realized that the kid had changed her usual tactics. She wasn't trying to obscure the location of her mental fortress with the usual tricks of darkness and fog. She had instead chosen a different method of obfuscation, building a sprawl of decoys, hiding the true core of her mind somewhere among them. Corpse-taker had countered her, it would seem, by the simple, if difficult, expedient of deciding to crush them all, even if it had to be done one at a time. That vast beast construct had been something more massive than I had ever attempted in my own imagination, though Molly had tossed some of those at me once or twice. It wasn't simply a matter of thinking big. There was an energy investment in creating something with that kind of mental mass, and Molly generally felt such huge, unsubtle thrusts weren't worth the effort they took, especially since someone with the right attitude and imagination would take them down with only moderately more difficulty than small constructs. Corpse-taker, though, evidently didn't agree. She was a lot older than Molly or me, and she would have deeper reserves of strength to call upon, greater discipline, and the confidence of long experience. The kid had managed to take on the corpse-taker on Molly's most familiar ground, and to play her hand in her strongest suit, but my apprentice's strength didn't look like it was holding up well against the necromancer's experience and expertise. I stopped paying attention to everything happening, all the artillery strikes and cavalry charges and shambling hordes of zombies and storms of knives that just came whirling out of the sky. The form of any given construct wasn't as important as the fact of its existence. A flying arrow that could pierce the heart, for example, was potentially just as dangerous as an animate shadow reaching out with smothering black talons. As long as one could imagine an appropriate construct to counter the threat, and do so in time to stop it, any construct could be defeated. It was a simple thing, at its most basic level, and it sounded easy. But once you're throwing out dozens or hundreds or thousands of offensive and defensive constructs at a time, believe me, it takes your full attention. It's also all you can do to deal with one opponent, which explained why I hadn't been assaulted by the corpse taker instantly, if she had even taken note of my presence at all. She and Molly were locked together tight. The soul gaze had probably played a part in that. Neither was letting go until her opponent was dead. Both combatants were throwing enormous amounts of offensive constructs at each other, even though Molly was demolishing her own defenses almost as rapidly as the corpse taker was. As tactics go, that one had two edges. Molly was hurting herself, but by doing so, she was preventing the corpse taker from pressing too closely, lest she be caught up in the vast bursts of destruction being exchanged. A mistake could easily destroy anyone's mind in that vista of havoc, centuries-old necromancer or not. On the other hand, if she spotted where Molly was fighting from, it looked like she'd have the power to drive in and crush my apprentice. But if she closed in on the wrong target, she'd leave herself wide open to a surprise attack from the real Molly. Corpse Taker had to know that, just as she had to know that if she simply kept on the pressure, the whole place would eventually be ground down, and Molly would be destroyed anyway. My apprentice had come with a good plan, but she had miscalculated. The Corpse Taker was a hell of a lot stronger than she had expected. Molly was playing the most aggressive defensive plan I'd ever seen, and hoping that she could pressure the Corpse Taker into making a mistake. It wasn't a good plan, but it was all she had. One way or another, it wasn't going to be a long fight. Best if I got moving. Molly was here somewhere in the sprawl of fake strongholds, and she would be just as hidden from me as from the corpse taker. But I had an advantage that the necromancer didn't. I knew my apprentice. This wasn't the never-never. We were in Molly's head, inside a world of thought and imagination. There was no magic involved. Not now that we were here, anyway. I might be a slender wisp of a ghost, but I still had my brain, and that gave me certain liberties here. I went over to the ruined building where the monster thing was groaning through its death. I heaved aside a piece of rubble and pulled a pale blue bathroom rug stained with dust and weird purple blood out of the wreckage. It was a tiny piece of environmental construct, but even so, it was a serious effort to appropriate it as my own. My arms shook with weakness as I lifted the carpet and snapped it once. Blood and dust flew from it, as if it had never existed, and then I settled it calmly on flat ground, sat on it, and folded my legs and my arms in front of me. "Up, Simba," I said in my best attempt to imitate Yul Brynner, and the carpet quivered and then rose off the ground, staying as rigid and almost as comfortable as a sheet of heavy plywood. It rose straight in the air, and as it did, I gripped the edges surreptitiously. It wouldn't do to have either my enemy or my apprentice get a glimpse of me flailing wildly for my balance as the carpet moved. But, on the other hand, I didn't want to just fall off, either. I could probably come up with something to keep me from getting hurt when I hit the ground, but it would look awfully bad, and I don't care how close to dead he might be. A wizard has his pride. Granted, the imagination was the only place where I was going to get one of these darn things to work. I tried the flying carpet thing before, when I was about 20. It had been a fairly horrible experiment that had dropped me into a not-yet-closed landfill during a thunderstorm. And then there was the famous flying broomstick incident of Wacker Drive, which wound up on the internet as a UFO sighting. After that, I had wisely determined that flying was mostly just a great way to get killed, and settled for driving my old car around instead. But, hey, in my imagination, that carpet had worked great. And that was how it went as a guest in Molly's imagination, too. I went up high enough to get a good view, and was impressed with the kid. The city of fortresses stretched for miles. There were hundreds of them, and fighting raged all the way through. It was the opposite of what the kid usually did in a mental battle. An inverse Mongol horde, with endless defenders pouring out like angry bees to defend the hive. Corpse Taker, unfortunately, was playing Mama Bear to Molly's Queen Bee. She'd get hurt coming in, but as long as she wasn't stupid, not very badly. She could crush all the defenders eventually, and then rip the hive to shreds. I leaned forward a little, and the carpet began to gather speed, moving ahead. Shifts of my weight to the left or right let me bank, and it wasn't long before I was cruising through the rain as fast as I could, and still keeping my eyes clear. I flew a spiral pattern, scanning the city beneath me. The battle kept going, in the skies, too. Mostly flying demon things and lightning bolts that kept smashing them out of the air. It got boring to watch after the first dozen spectacular lightning strikes or so, and I tuned that conflict out too as I kept searching. Finally, I spotted what I was looking for. A ruined building that had been reduced to a crater by an artillery shell or some other explosion. It was impossible to tell what it had been from what was left, and burned rubble covered the area around it, coating a thick-bodied old oak tree and the treehouse on its lower branches in dust, dirt, and debris. I went past the treehouse without stopping or slowing down for several more minutes, and then went evasive. I couldn't be sure the corpse taker didn't know I had ridden in on her coattails, and if she was following me, or had sent a construct to do so, I didn't want to lead her to Molly. So the carpet went from 40 or 50 miles an hour to more than 100, and at the same time I constructed a veil around me so that I surged forward and simply vanished. I flew low, snaking through the streets, and only after I'd crossed my own trail 5 or 6 times without spotting anything shadowing me did I finally soar into the treehouse. It looked like a miniature home, with a door and siding and trim and windows and everything. A rope ladder allowed one to climb up to the porch, but it had been pulled up. I floated up to the door on the flying carpet and knocked politely. "I have you now," I said, as much like James Earl Jones as I could. "I do a better Yul Brynner." Molly's strained face appeared at the window, and she blinked.
"Harry?"
"What's with the come hither, grasshopper?" I asked. "You practically vacuumed me in with a corpse taker." Molly narrowed her eyes and said, "What was I wearing the first time we met?" I blinked at her, opened my mouth, closed it, thought about it, and then said,
"Oh, come on, Moll. I have no idea. Clothes? You were like 8 years old, and your mom tried to shut the door in my face, and I was there to see your dad."
She nodded once, as if that was the answer she'd been looking for, and opened the door.
"Come on."
I went into the treehouse with her. The inside was bigger than the outside. You can do that sort of thing in your imagination. It's kind of fun. I've got one closet of my castle that looks like a giant disco roller rink. The roller skaters come after you like Juggernaut. The music makes heads explode, and the mirror ball distributes a killer laser beam. Molly's headquarters looked like the bridge of, I kid you not, the USS Enterprise. The old one. The one that was full of dials that obviously didn't do anything, and that had a high-pitched, echoing cricket chirp going off every 5 or 6 seconds. There was an upside to that setting, though. Molly was wearing one of the old 60s miniskirt uniforms. Look, I'm not interested in a relationship with the kid. I do love her tremendously, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't look fantastic. Anyone with eyes can see that. And I've always been the kind of person who can appreciate gorgeous scenery without feeling a need to go camping in it. Actually, glancing around, there were about 6 Mollies, all of them wearing old 60s miniskirt uniforms, each of them manning a different station. The one who had opened the door had jet black hair in a neat, almost mathematical gamine-style cut and slightly pointed ears.
"Star Trek?" I asked her. "Really?"
"What?" she demanded, bending unnaturally black eyebrows together. "There are 2 kinds of people in the universe, Molly," I said. "Star Trek fans and Star Wars fans. This is shocking." She sniffed. "This is the post-nerd closet world, Harry. It's okay to like both."
"Blasphemy and lies," I said.
She arched an eyebrow at me with Nemoisian perfection and went back to her station. Communications officer Molly, in the red uniform with a curly black fro and a silver object the size of a toaster in her ear, said, "Quadrant 4 is below 5%, and the extra pressure is being directed at Quadrant 3. Captain Molly, in her gold outfit, with her hair in a precise Jacqueline Onassis do, spun the bridge chair toward communications Molly and said, "Pull out everything and shift it to quadrant 3 ahead of them." The chair spun back toward Science Officer Molly. "Set off the nukes in 4. Science Molly arched an eyebrow askance. "Oh, hush, I'm the captain. You're the first officer, and that's that," snapped Captain Molly. "We're fighting a war here, so set off the nukes. Hi, Harry." "Molly," I said, "nukes?"
"I was saving them as a surprise," she said.
There was a big TV screen at the front of the room. Not a flat screen, a big, slightly curved old CRT. It went bright white all of a sudden. "Ensign," Captain Molly said. Ensign Molly, dressed in a red uniform, wearing braces on her teeth, and maybe 10 years younger than Captain Molly, twiddled some of the dials that didn't do anything, and the bright white light dimmed down. From outside, there was a long scream, an enormous one, like Godzilla-sized, or maybe bigger. Everyone on the bridge froze. A brass section from nowhere played an ominous sting. "Bum, bum!" "You're kidding," I said, looking around. "A soundtrack?"
"I don't mean to,"
Ensign Molly said in a strained teenager tone. She had a Russian accent that sounded exactly like Sonya.
"I've watched show too much when I was kid, okay?"
"Your brain is a very strange place," I said. I meant it as a compliment, and it showed in my voice. Ensign Molly gave me a glowing grin and turned back to her station. I walked to the right-hand side of the captain's chair and folded my arms. The screen came up to light again, showing a devastated section of the city grid. No, not decimated. Had that part of the city been decimated, 1 out of every 10 buildings would be destroyed. That's what decimated means. Personally, I think some early years respected television personality got decimated and devastated, confused at some point, and no one wanted to point it out to him. So everyone started using them interchangeably. But damn it, words mean what they mean, even if everyone thinks they ought to mean something else. Science Molly spoke in a grim voice. "Nuclear detonation confirmed. Enemy forces in Quadrant 4 have been decimated, Captain." I pressed my lips firmly together. "Thank you, Number 1, Captain Molly said, spinning back to face the front. "Harry, help?" "Not sure what I can do, Grasshopper," I told her seriously. "I barely managed to steal a bathroom rug from some rubble and whip up a flying carpet. Her stuff goes right through me, and vice versa." She looked at me for a moment, and I saw the same look of fear flicker over every face on the bridge. Then she took a deep breath, nodded, and turned to face the front. She started giving smooth orders, and her other selves replied in calm, steady voices. After a few moments, Captain Molly said,
"If you aren't here to... I mean, if you can't help, why are you here?"
"Because you're here," I said calmly. "Least I can do is stand with you."
"If she wins," Captain Molly swallowed, "you'll die."
I snorted and flashed her a grin. "Best thing about being a spook, Grasshopper, I'm already dead." "Quadrant 3 is collapsing," Communications Officer Molly reported. "Quadrant 2 is at 20%. Captain Molly bit her lip. "How many quadrants?" I asked her. 4, she said, "since, you know, quadrants." I wanted to say something about decimated, but I didn't. "We're in Quadrant 1. Captain Molly nodded.
"I don't think I can stop her, Harry."
"Fight's not over until it's over, kid," I said. "Don't let her beat you. Make her work for it." Science Molly said in a firm tone, "Death is not the only consequence here. Should the corpse taker prevail, she will have full access to our talents, abilities, memories, and knowledge. Even though we have spent the last months distancing ourselves from others to insulate against a situation such as this one, the corpse taker could still inflict considerable damage on not only our friends and family, but on complete innocence. That is unacceptable, Captain." Captain Molly looked from Science Molly to me and then said,
"The fight isn't over yet. Prepare the Omega Bomb, but do not deploy."
"Aye, aye," said Science Molly, and she stood up and strode to the other side of the bridge, and an old wooden cabinet beside an old wooden door.
I blinked at it. Wow, that's kind of out of theme.
Captain Molly coughed loudly. That's nothing to worry about. Pay it no mind. I watched Science Molly get a device the size of a small microwave out of the old cabinet and push one button on it. Then she set it on the console next to her. I said, Omega Bomb? The corpse taker doesn't get me, Captain Molly said in a firm tone. Ever. And it's in that old wooden cabinet because...
I don't know what you're talking about, Captain Molly said dismissively. Ensign, bring up the screen for Quadrant 2.
I eased away from Captain Molly as she kept commanding the battle and went over to stand next to Science Molly.
The captain doesn't seem to want me to know about that door.
Definitely not, said Science Molly, also in confidential tones.
It's a need-to-know door.
Why?
Because if you know about it, you're one of the ones who needs to know about it,
she replied calmly.
And if you don't, it's better that you not know. The captain feels you've suffered enough.
Suffered enough? I asked. What do you mean?
I have nothing further to say on the subject, said Science Molly.
It's my fault, Ensign Molly said. Sorry. Look, I don't mean to... with the cabinet and the door, okay? But I can't help it.
You ever get the feeling you're standing in a room full of crazy people? I got that feeling. It isn't a very nice feeling. I stared at the door and the old wooden cabinet. It wasn't a particularly outstanding door in any way. A standard hanging door, if rather old and battered. Ditto the cabinet. Both had been stained a medium brown, apparently a very long time ago. Both were covered with dings and dents, not as though something had tried to break them down, but simply from years and years of use. They looked sort of familiar. I studied the door and the cabinet thoughtfully, glancing occasionally at the big old CRT as Quadrant 2 buckled under the corpse taker's assault. The fighting had been fierce, but she still hadn't revealed herself, and Molly hadn't managed to kill her with the nukes or the assault would have ended with her. Another quadrant went, and Captain Molly detonated another set of massive nuke constructs. Then a third and more nukes. Neither of the second pair of detonations was followed by a massive scream, the way the first one had been. Molly had bloodied the corpse taker, presumably, but it hadn't been enough.
"Damn it," Captain Molly said, clenching one fist and staring at the screen. "She's got to be near now, but where?"
The streets outside were so full of battling constructs that they were literally piling up with bodies, slowing the progress of the enemy, but not stopping it.
"Damn it," I felt helpless.
Just standing next to the kid wasn't going to do her any good, but I was holding on to the world by a thread. I just didn't have the ability to make things happen, either here or in the real world. All I could do was use my freaking brain.
Duh.
Wait, I said. Molly, I've got an idea. All the Mollies turned to look at me. I turned to Captain Molly.
Slow her down, I said. You've got to slow the corpse taker down. Whatever you have to do, you need to buy some time. Go.
Captain Molly blinked at me. Then she turned and started snapping orders. The bridge Mollies started twisting dials and punching keys. I turned to communications Molly. Hey, you do communications, right? She looked baffled.
Right.
We need to communicate, I said. You need to make a long-distance call.
Now?
Communications Molly said, her eyes widening.
Right the hell now, I corrected her.
I leaned down and explained what I needed in terse tones.
That's going to be tricky, she said. We're already at 100% on the reactor.
I put on my best Sean Connery voice. Then go to 110%. Science Molly arched an eyebrow at me and punched a button.
Engineering, bridge.
Aye,
screamed a furious Scottish-accented Molly.
What do you want now?
More power, engineer.
The answer was a furious rush of pure profanity, but the deep engine hum in the background around us went upward a bit, and the floor started to vibrate. Science Molly pointed at Communications Molly and said,
Go!
Mayday, Communications Molly said into her console. This is a mayday, emergency transmission. We urgently require assistance. Suddenly everything lurched to one side, and we all staggered.
Oh, I don't believe this crap, I muttered.
She's found us, Captain, said Science Molly. Shields at 70%. Hit her with everything, Captain Molly snapped.